I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rashi Iyer. She is a pulmonary toxicologist from Los Alamos National Laboratory, and she's the principal investigator for the ATHENA Project. ATHENA stands for Advanced Tissue Engineered Human Ectopal Network Analyzer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are doing something that's almost like science fiction at Los Alamos, which is you're developing human organ constructs, liver, heart, lung, and kidney. What is a human organ construct?
So basically, to give you a little background, this idea has been thrown around for some time, and the reason is because if you ever think about it, looking at drug screening, for example, it takes 12 to 15 years for a drug to get from discovery to the patient. And it costs, the latest study that they did, it costs about an average of $2.6 billion to get a drug into the market. And so it's extremely expensive to perform drug screening. Most of it is expensive than drug screening. And the methods that are currently used for drug screening have been used for decades, and there's really been no improvement in the process. So, for example, like we always say, there's always scope for improvement, but we've been using animal models for years and in vitro cultures, you know, basically monolayer cell cultures of cells that are either transformed. Sometimes they're primary cells, but very often they're transformed cells. And so they don't really present, basically the cells in a petri dish, a plastic petri dish, right? And they don't really represent what we are. And the other one is animal studies, which again, it's really hard to extrapolate. So a lot of drugs actually fail when they get into the clinical phase simply because you might have cured the rat and send him home. But when it reaches human trials, it fails. And so there's been a lot of push in trying to get something more human relevant out there, and because the development of technology is such a rapid rate in the past couple of decades, engineering materials, novel materials, for example, nanomaterials that are biocompatible, that it's now possible to develop artificial tissues and potentially artificial organs that would more closely simulate human responses.
Now, what you're testing for, you know, when drugs come to market and you're doing these screenings, is whether or not A, they're toxic to humans, mm-hmm. and B, they're effective.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And so you've got these human organ constructs. What are they actually made of?
So they're made of, in the case of the ATHENA construct, they're made of primary human cells. So basically, these are donors. Or, for example, in the case of liver, you have a patient who goes to a hospital and there's a liver biopsy, and then you get a significant amount of that. You take the cells out of that. You construct an artificial liver organ. And, you know, imagine, if you will, a biopsy. And that's really what this is. It's very much, if you think about it, if you take a human and slice them and just take a thin slice and perform experiments.
Yeah, so they'll put a needle into you, extract some tissue from some organ. That's the biopsy. And so then that would be used to make a kind of artificial. So it's really made of human cells.
Exactly. It's made of human cells. But, for example, in some of the cases, in some of the organ systems, architecture is not important, or it's not that relevant to the endpoint, for example, toxicology. But in some organ systems, architecture becomes very important. The structure of the organ becomes very important.
So architecture, what do you mean?
For example, the lung, right? You have a branched bronchial system. You have lobes. You have a branched bronchial system. And then they end in these structures that are balloon-like, where the gas exchange occurs. So you have cells that undergo mechanical stress, for example. You have cells that grow at the air-liquid interface. They're air on one side, liquid at the basal end, and air at the apical end. And architecture now becomes important because, for example, when you inhale substances, right, and we do that all the time, where they go in the lung is very much dictated by the architecture, the structure of the lung. Okay. And so how deep they go into the lung, the smaller the particle is, the deeper it goes, because it moves faster and penetrate your lung system, pulmonary system. And so in some cases, architecture and structure become important. So even though our systems are made out of human cells, you now have to develop a scaffold on which these cells can grow. So that's where the biocompatible materials come in. And then you also have to have, hopefully in the case of the lung, for example, a structure and architecture that simulates that, on which you put these cells.
And so you've got a simulated, I mean, it's sort of like half human, half artificial, or I don't know what percentage is, but that's made of human tissue, and then you would be able to perform screenings on that to see how that tissue responds to various substances. Now, do you have genetic variation, like one person's lung or one person's liver and another person's are significantly different? Some
right.
people have better livers than
correct,
others.
Correct. So, and that is very true. And you see those differences when you look at the data. For example, when you expose, say, a liver from four different donors and you expose it to Tylenol, for example, which is a classic liver toxin. And when you expose it, you see different responses. But there's always a range of what we call normal range of responses. And as long as your responses are within that range. Now, that's not to say that all our liver systems come within that range. So there are studies that would be off the scale, for example, and then you'd either have to make the decision whether you want to throw that study out and say, okay, maybe this liver is just too messed up, or whether you want to say, well, this is a liver, this is an interesting observation because this is a liver that is so messed up, and so now you can see these responses. So it gives you an insight, for example, in a very diseased liver, you expect that it would respond much more negatively to Tylenol, because it's already a disease in a sick liver. And so you'd see that in your data. So we really want to try, and actually one of the things we try to do, pay attention to, is that, because we really want to see what the range of responses would be amongst different donors, you know.
And so do you, I mean, how far along is this? Do you have these organ constructs up and running?
Yes, so we do have the liver organ constructs up and running. Validation is a big thing, of obviously, and they're currently being validated. We've done a lot of preliminary validation that we feel pretty confident that we have a good liver system. The heart system is nearly there, and we've done some validation initially with the heart system with drugs, well-known cardiotoxins, and the systems are behaving as expected. We are in the process of the lung, developing the lung, and we hope to have that ready by the end of this year. And then we have the kidney. So everything is really running in parallel, but they're different stages. You know, you have to design your bioreactor. You have to identify cells, a source for cells. Some, for example, in the case of the heart, we use pluripotent stem cells in the case of the heart. And so in some case, we are using, you know, primary cells from a donor. In other cases, we're using cells that are, you know, some kind of adult stem cells that we then differentiate into what we want. And so it's a combination. It totally depends upon availability. I mean, there are some cells that are just hard to come by. And very often, these cells, even if we do get them, once you take them out of the body, they behave very differently. And so those are things we have to consider when we are, you know, choosing our cells.
So if you have a kidney construct, let's say, it's made from donor cells from a live person. Well, the way our kidneys stay alive is they have blood supply and we're continually eating and drinking and keeping them nutrified. How do you do that in these artificial constructs?
That's an excellent question, actually. So most of the cells, a lot of the cells that we use, for example, they have media, or what you know, the nutrient that is very specifically developed for those cells. So they really take into account the needs of those cells. But you know that we all have the blood system, which is really an organ by itself, and it feeds the entire body and it feeds all the organs. And so the key challenge here, if you want these systems to communicate with each other, is to actually develop something very similar to blood that allows for these organ systems to survive when they're communicating with you. So one of our major focuses actually is developing what the sponsor likes to call blood surrogate, but we really like to call it universal media, that will allow for the health of all these organ systems when we put them together. And so we are working on that. This is not trivial at all. It's a challenge, and that's simply because when people, you know, when scientists developed, they were interested, say they were liver scientists, or they were studying the liver organ, I should call it hepatic toxicity, for example. They developed media or nutrient source that was very specific for that. Now what we have to do is try to develop something that's more commonly used by all the organ systems. And so you provide nutrients that are very specific for the survival.
You would have to, in order to do screenings, let's say there's a new drug that you're developing, you want to know if it's toxic, you want to know that it's effective on various organs. These organs, I mean, your and my liver are sitting there doing what they're doing and doing right. Their filtering, and so are our kidneys and our lungs are breathing and our hearts are pumping. And all of those things exist within what we might call the ecosystem of the human body, all in relation to one another. Do those relationships occur, or will they occur in the kind of work that you're doing?
So that is what our hope is, that they will occur. And that's why one of the things I didn't mention earlier is that a lot of these studies that we do, in vitro studies or outside the body studies, they've done very much in isolation. So we don't, we'll take a lung cell, we put the drug on there, and we look at the response. But the lung cell is not communicating with the liver cell, and that's very key. It's very important. And so in this case, yes, we would like to see the response of one organ and how it affects the response of another organ. A lot of the drugs that, for example, a cardiotoxin, sometimes it's not directly toxic to the heart.
What would be an example of a cardiotoxin?
There is diclofenac, which is a cardiotoxin. There's isoproterenol, which is a cardiotoxin, in the sense that they increase the heart rate, for example. So if you have these, they are antibiotics that are cardiotoxic, but the key is that most drugs are metabolized by the liver. And so very often it's a metabolic product that is toxic to the organ, target organ. So if you don't have the liver there, what you're seeing is really just the drug. If I take a drug and just throw it in the heart, I may or may not see cardiotoxicity, because it's really the metabolic product of that drug that's cardiotoxic. And that's where the liver becomes important, for example.
And you may find a drug which is, let's say, very healing to the heart, but really toxic to the liver.
Very
in which
true.
Case, it's no good.
Exactly, which is why so many of the drugs reach clinical phase and then get pulled back, because they were great for the target organ, but they turned out to be toxic to some other organ, and you just can't use it.
We're talking to Rashi Iyer, who is a pulmonary toxicologist, about human organ constructs, and it seems like, I mean, there's so many challenges to this project. One is making these little, laboratory livers and hearts and lungs and so on work. Another is keeping them alive. Another is having enough genetic variation that when you test things on them, that your results are universal enough
right. To
be significant. And then I would think there's questions of scale, like you develop this stuff to the point where you have to test just the way you would do it. You wouldn't do a clinical trial on two people. You'd do it on, 100 or 1,000 people.
Right, right.
Then you've got to have a lot of this material.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that's correct. And that's a challenge, because none of these systems, especially at this point, development phase may not be that cheap. But as we go into production phase, when you have a constant source for the cells, or you've developed a prototype bioreactor, and now all you have to do is develop 1,000 of those in which you can put your cells in. Obviously, the more we have to produce, the cheaper the product gets. And though expense is important, it's not cheap to maintain animals too, but it's really the relevance of the systems that is the key driver out here. animals have always been the gold standard, and I'm not expecting that suddenly the FDA will be okay with no animal studies, for example. But we need something that's in that gap between animal and clinical, human clinical studies, that becomes very important. There's a drug, Fialuridine, I can't quite ever get the name right, and it's for treatment of hepatitis B. And the drug, when it hit clinical phase, they treated 15 patients with it, and it ended in fatalities of 5 patients, and 7 patients got really sick.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, this was a very costly drug, if you think about it in terms of life. It becomes a very costly drug.
And the animals didn't react badly to it?
No. This is a classic case I use. The animals were fine. Rats, like we said, we sent healthy rats back home, but the humans didn't do so well. And it turned out that it was a mitochondrial toxin, but the animal mitochondria were just fine. And the reason is because the membrane of the human mitochondria is different from that of animals. And so this drug got through the mitochondrial membrane, but it couldn't get through the rat mitochondrial membrane.
Very interesting. Yeah. So this is something that would really save human lives if it could be brought to...
That's correct.
...to scale.
And the other thing is we could really reduce the years required for a drug to reach a patient,
right.
and the expense, and it gives an incentive for pharma to invest in what I call low return drugs, you know, rare diseases, for example, that they may not have such a great market for, so they're not willing to spend, you know, close to $3 billion on a drug that won't get that return, or in drugs, or in disease, for diseases in poorer nations where there is a need for that disease. Ebola is a classic example, but they're not interested in investing in that because the returns are low.
Right, and who knows, in some kind of perfect world, it might actually drive down the price of drugs for all kinds of diseases.
And it should, because if your upfront cost is low, the hope is that they would pass that savings down to the consumer, you know.
The hope is.
Yes.
We say, in quotes. Meanwhile, if this were brought to the level, I mean, it's, as you're saying, in the research and development stage right now, but it were brought to the level that it could use, it might happen before animal studies.
Exactly. It could. Yeah. You know, definitely before we went to, you know, and it totally depends upon how the study is designed. If you could do it before the animal studies or you could do it after the animal studies to confirm the animal studies, the earlier example that I gave you for the hepatitis B drug, you know, this might have told us, because after the fact, after the fatality, they did several in vitro human screening assays and they found that the drug was toxic in those cells. And, you know, perhaps that would have saved lives if we had found that out earlier. Yeah.
It also makes you really think about how scary being a part of a clinical trial can be.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, my son went to college 2 years ago and I told him, I mean, they're always looking for volunteers in college. I'm like, that's no way to make money.
And you should know.
That's right.
We're talking to Rashi Iyer, pulmonary toxicologist from Los Alamos National Laboratory. Now, it does make you think not only how scary clinical trials are, but like where the expenses are in the various stages of taking a drug from an idea to the pharmacy.
Right.
And where, I mean, I don't know if this is really your field, but where does the money get spent? Like, why are they, I mean, it costs $1 billion to take a drug to market. That's a huge amount of money. Where's the most of that being spent?
So currently, it's because there was, you know, there's a lot of drug development. There are actually thousands, if not millions of compounds out there that are awaiting screening. Okay. And so most of the money is in the screening process. That's where most of the money is spent. You know, you have some amount obviously spent in synthesis of these drugs or development of these drugs and the initial testing. But most of this is spent on screening, and that's where the biggest challenge is too, because what are the models you use? Do you use a primate? Do you use a rat? And so that's where a lot of the decisions are made, and the expenses of drug is based. I mean, there's some drugs that are best tested in primates, and primates are very, very expensive.
And they're so much like us that you get into sort of ethical and moral concerns about torturing a monkey.
That's exactly right. I don't think I would be able to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's person to person, but I think, you know, one of the reasons is ethical reasons for sacrificing animals when we don't, might not need to. And it's not, again, I'm not, you know, a few people are sensitive about this. They really feel that animal studies are important, and I totally understand that. But it's reducing the amount of use and using the relevant animal type that's important.
Yeah. And so when you're using these organ constructs, and it is a kind of, I mean, I've said sort of half facetiously that it's like science fiction, but you've basically got these, I don't even know what they look like, but things on your lab bench that are made of human cells, and they're being kept alive, but they're not alive in the sense that you and I are alive.
No, definitely not. No. I mean, they're not innervated with nerves, for example, so it's not like they feel pain or anything. They're just cells. And so, and we've been using cells for decades, right? Now we're just using them in a more complex, complex format. We're just a little more attuned to the environment, and that's what we are now playing with. We're tuning it so that we really have cells that behave as they would behave in a human, rather than, because we know they behave very differently in a plastic dish. So
what does the heart construct, for example, look like?
So actually the heart construct, and we're really excited about that, it's a really cool thing. It looks like, it actually looks like a heart. It looks like a classic heart. So it's like a cup shape heart, which is hollow on the inside. The heart cells, or what we call the cardiomyocytes, are nothing but muscle cells for the heart, are on the outside. So it's a scaffold that looks like a cup or a little heart. And then you have the muscle cells on that scaffold that perform the function of what cardiomyocytes do. So we have shown that the heart can pump. The pumping volume is very low, so we're working on that. So it contracts. I mean, it beats just like a human heart. And so it responds to drugs. We've shown that if you put in a drug that increases heart rate, for example, you can see this heart beat faster. And if you take a drug that reduces heart rate, you can see it go low. So you can
actually... It's so weird.
It is. Very, very... It's sort of bizarre. You know, and so it's a thing that we show a lot of our, you know, people who want to come and see what we're doing. It sort of gives them an idea of what's going on here. You know?
Now, do you keep it at 98.6 Fahrenheit?
So, yeah, it's kept around 37 degrees, which is the classic temperature that we use for all our experiments, because that's what body temperature is. So it's kept at 37. You give it the right...
37 sort of, centigrade,
that's 98.6. Yeah, 98.6,
yeah. So this work is a multi-university collaboration. Who are some of your other collaborators?
It's Vanderbilt, UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, CFDRC, which is Computational Fluid Dynamics Research Center in Alabama. It's a company, Charité University of Berlin in Germany, and Harvard, WIS Institute. And so these are the collaborators. Each one brings a lot to the table. It was a consortium that we formed based on expertise. Each one is responsible for some very specific task. It's difficult to have all the expertise in one institute.
Right.
LANL is very, very multidisciplinary, so we have a lot of engineering, microfabrication, materials, biology expertise, and LANL is responsible for guiding the research, bringing it all together, integrating the systems, validation, so on. So a lot of the bulk of the work is done at LANL. It's been really interesting. We do a demo every year. We do a dry demo for ourselves to make sure everything works, and then we do a demo for the sponsor. Analysis is very important. I don't think I mentioned that. But, you know, a system is only as good as you can analyze it. So one of the, I would say, drawbacks or challenges with animal models, for example, is it's a lot of non-mechanistic based studies. So, you know, it's observational. And then you have ex vivo, that if you think lung is, for example, the target organ, you take out the lung and you look at what's happening in the lung. This is actually mechanistic too. So you can not only understand whether your liver is croaking, but you can understand why it's croaking. You can understand what's going on, what pathway is affected, what protein is affected, whatever is happening on a very molecular level. And then you can either develop a drug that, you can take the same drug and change it so it doesn't impact that pathway, or you can understand better, this is the pathway that's involved in disease, for example. So
right.
It's great. So it's a very good mechanistic tool.
So it could help doctors and researchers understand the organs in which they specialize.
Exactly, yeah. And so the analysis is very deep. We do molecular level. We use mass spec to do...
Mass spectroscopy.
That's correct. Ion mobility mass spectroscopy. And we look at a very sort of in-depth what's going on. And then we use classical tools that are used in a clinic, iStat or Piccolo, that are, if you go to a hospital or clinic, these are the classical tools that they use to monitor you. So our system, when you go in to a hospital, they don't open you up. They take a blood sample, they take a urine sample, they take a stool sample, and then they analyze it. And that's exactly the idea behind Athena. We don't want to perturb the system. We really want to treat it like a patient who's come in for a physical, for example, and or even a patient who is unable to tell you what's going on with them, right? An infant, for example, who's unable to tell you that it's sick or it's got a headache. And how do you monitor this? You do urine and blood samples. And that's exactly what we do here, is the blood sample is, the universal media, the blood surrogate that flows through the system, and then you have the kidney, so we will have a urine sample. And we'll be able to do classic analysis that you would do in a clinic, glucose, lactate, pH, their panels, cholesterol, heart toxicity, for example, their panels that doctors use in hospitals and clinics. And so
if this gets to that production level where it really is being used in the ways that you're describing, it's still conceivable that there may be differences between what your organ constructs are having in terms of reactions and what human beings are having.
Right. And that's correct. I think it's going to be impossible, at least in my lifetime or in my research lifetime, to develop an identical clone of a human that responds exactly like that. And so it's a bit of a reductionist approach, right? You want to understand key responses, because after doing, research and toxicity and efficacy studies for years, for decades, we have a pretty good handle. I think scientists have a very good handle on what the classic toxic responses are, what are the pathways that are impacted. And so what you want your system to do is simulate these responses as close as possible. And that's really what we are trying to achieve over here. What is important that we are trying to monitor? But as I mentioned, a lot of the mass spec work is discovery mode too. So we can do targeted analysis. I can tell, we can tell the mass spec to look for certain things. Or I can say, discovery mode. So we might be able to understand mechanisms or identify biomarkers that have never been identified before. That would give us a lot of preclinical information, which is very key, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we could prevent a lot of diseases getting as bad as they are if we could understand them much earlier, or we could see signs of these diseases. Biomarkers that, we look for things that are very, very well established and obvious, but that might be too late. So you might miss the therapeutic window. And so what we're trying, this might be a great tool to understand or identify biomarkers that are very early in the process.
So in addition to, if I understand correctly, in addition to screening drugs for toxicity and efficacy, you might also eventually learn things that help to prevent diseases in the first place.
That's totally accurate. So really, a lot of disease modeling, for example, that we could understand diseases at an earlier stage, not having to wait till the symptoms actually show up.
Yeah.
And by that time, it's mostly, as you know, very late. Yeah.
We're talking to pulmonary toxicologist Rashi Iyer. Now, when all of this, assuming that everything goes well and the research and development stage goes into prototype, which then goes into production, and you've got bajillions of artificial construct organs like kidneys and livers and hearts and lungs, who owns that? I mean, does that become a company? I mean, it's obviously taxpayer funded.
That's correct. That's correct. And so we're looking into that at this point. We're still in the process because we're so much into the R&D. We've thought about it. And we're thinking about it more seriously now as to how does this, you know, how does this translate into a commercial product and how do we work that out? Obviously, pharma will be interested and should be interested in that. But as you said, this is taxpayers' money, and so it has to be for the benefit of the taxpayers. And so I can't really say much about that, but we're exploring options on how we're going to get this to commercialization.
So this work is funded by the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. How is this helpful to threat reduction?
Well, you know, part of the agenda is national security, and that is protecting the American public against diseases. Ebola is a classic example. Nobody ever thought it would come across borders and continents, and it did because of globalization. And so these become a concern to any agency that's involved in protecting the American citizen. And so this is one of the things. The other thing is medical countermeasures. You know, it's warfighter support, for example. Or really, they're really interested in sort of fast-tracking drug development for biological agents or chemical threat agents that they might be exposed to.
So if some rogue nation or group decides to try to spray us or somebody with toxic agents, we would be better equipped to find and quickly test drugs to defend ourselves.
That's correct. I mean, there are some well-known toxic agents that we can't talk about, but they need to have antidotes for those. So they need to be just be prepared for it, and that's all. And that's really, so it's very proactive in trying to get antidotes out there that would be effective.
Rashi Iyer is a pulmonary toxicologist from Los Alamos National Laboratory. She's principal investigator of the Athena Project, and once again, that stands for Advanced Tissue Engineered Human Ectopical Network Analyzer. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.